Thank you very much, David. Good afternoon, everybody. If you read the background of Charles Powell, I'm thinking, how in the world am I going to introduce him? You were thinking, with my background, how in the world did you ever cross paths with that person? Charles is chairman of the International Advisory Board of Rolls-Royce, chairman of LVMH Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton in the UK, on the board of the Mandarin Oriental Hotel Group in Bermuda. For 9.5 years, he was private secretary and advisor on foreign affairs and defense to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and for a shorter time for Prime Minister John Major. He has been a member of the House of Lords since 1990. I have made the very tough decision that when I come back in this world, I want to be Charles's wife. In the United States, he serves on the boards of Caterpillar and Textron. The latter is where he and I serve together. That's how I got to know Charles. He has a strong understanding of doing business in Asia. He is a director of Jemine Matheson Holdings, owner of 50% of the land in the business sector of Hong Kong. For 10 years, he was chairman of both the China British Council and the Singapore British Council. He served as chairman of the government's Asia Task Force and honorary president of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Far Eastern Business. He was educated at the King's School of Canterbury and New College, Oxford, where he obtained a first-class honors degree in history. He serves as chairman of the trustees of the Side Business School at Oxford University. He is also a trustee of the Aspen Institute right here in Colorado. When Charles and I had lunch recently, I did not ask my wife, Robin, to join me for fear she might think about jumping ship. Considering his impressive connections, one might assume he's a little pompous or a little stuffy. Just the opposite is true. He is not full of himself. He's modest. He's engaged. He's approachable. He has a good sense of humor and is a wonderful person. He is married, has 2 adult children, and lives in both London and Rome. It is a real pleasure for me to welcome and introduce Lord Charles Powell of Bayswater, KCMG. Thank you, Charles.
Well, David and Tom, thank you very much for those brief words of introduction. I'm interested, Tom, in the idea of your being my wife. I didn't know that Florida had changed the law yet. No doubt they're working on it. I must say, I don't think I've ever looked out on a healthier looking audience. Those tans are just unbelievable for a poor, pallid, white Englishman who hasn't seen the sun for months. And one other thing I would say, I think this tradition you have of having the high school students is just wonderful. I thought they did a great job of explaining themselves and their ambitions, and you're very fortunate in the United States to have young people like that with those ambitions, and that's what's going to ensure that this country remains truly great. Now, it's a great privilege to be asked to be invited to address this group. It's a very distinguished one, I can tell that just by looking at you. Frankly, I'm a bit amazed that you have any appetite for speeches anymore after the Republican primary has only just been through here. Well, you've discussed such world-shattering events as Governor Romney's income tax and what Speaker Gingrich was doing at Fannie Mae, and how can I possibly compete with any of that? Tom, you were kind in your introductory comments. You know, when people introduce Henry Kissinger, they tend to say, Dr. Kissinger needs no introduction. And Henry always stands up and says, I may not need an introduction, but no one enjoys one more than I do. Well, I certainly need one, and you've been very generous, and I've enjoyed it, but I shan't make the mistake of believing it. Now, the invitation to speak came from Tom, who is truly a prince among men. He and I were colleagues, as he said, for many years on the board of Textron, and we miss him a lot there. Tom was, frankly, a model director, calm, sagacious, always focused on the essentials and not the petty details. I learned a very great deal from him, and I shall always be grateful for that. Now, Tom asked me to talk about several things, perhaps touch on several things. One was Margaret Thatcher and working all that time for her. And another was Asia, and particularly China, where, as he said, I spend a great deal of my time. And I'll say a quick word also about Europe, because of the problems there at the moment and the economic effects of those problems. And when it comes to questions, please do ask questions about anything, whether I've spoken about them or not. I'm happy to take questions on, frankly, any subject. Now, as Tom said, I worked for Margaret Thatcher for a pretty long time when she was Prime Minister, and I was notionally her national security advisor. She was, in fact, her own national security advisor, but I just had to pretend. And I think probably in those years I saw more of her than anyone else except her husband, Dennis. And now, of course, she's very much in the news again with the film Iron Lady, where she is played by Meryl Streep. I have to say I've not seen the film, and I don't intend to see the film. And that's nothing to do with Meryl Streep, whose performance, I'm told, is outstanding. In fact, I went to see Meryl Streep before she made the film and to talk about Margaret Thatcher as I knew her. And I found Meryl Streep a highly intelligent and perceptive lady. But it just doesn't seem right to me to make a film portraying someone suffering from senile dementia when they are still alive. I'm not priggish. I still see Margaret Thatcher every week or so, and it's a difficult and painful time for her. And I'm not convinced it's really either proper or respectful to make her a subject for a film. And I doubt a film about Ronald Reagan's struggle with Alzheimer's would have gone down very well in the United States. But let's move on. Margaret Thatcher was really an extraordinary person to work with. It was like living inside a tornado. She was ceaselessly turbulent and active, always seeking new dragons to slay, whether they were union leaders, Argentine generals, or Soviet communists. And she was armed with that formidable weapon, her handbag. She introduced the term handbagging into the dictionary, and I had to learn to duck at just the right moment. She worked unbelievable hours, sitting up every night until 3 a.m., starting again at 6 a.m., as she labored to master every detail of every issue which came her way. Forget about weekends and holidays, they were not on the menu. And the fact that my wife never divorced me is quite remarkable. I don't know how it happened. Margaret Thatcher has always been a striver, someone who made her own way in the world by her own efforts, and against really quite great odds. Above all, the odds of being a woman in a rather snobbish, male-dominated political system, starting, in her case, from very humble beginnings. Her father was a small shopkeeper, and he taught her some simple principles of hard work, self-reliance, value for money, principles which she later applied to running the country. Now, they may sound familiar virtues to you in the great free market of the United States, but they had been pretty much eroded in post-war Britain until she restored them. When Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister in 1979, Britain was, frankly, in a shocking state. The unions seemed to be running the country, with strikes a permanent feature. We had runaway inflation in the teens. The highest rate of marginal tax was 97%. Let me just say that again, 97%. We had a dependency culture feeding off an unaffordable welfare state. And it didn't seem to make much difference whether Conservatives or Labour formed the government. No one seemed willing or able to do anything about the problems. They were just accepted as a given. Our national morale was shot to pieces, and Britain seemed to be in inexorable decline, a sad fate for a country which had emerged as one of the victors of World War II. Now, what was extraordinary about Margaret Thatcher is that she simply did not and would not accept the inevitability of decline. She refused to accept conventional wisdom that just because something had always been so, it didn't mean it had to be so in future. She knew that Britain needed fundamental change, and she had the extraordinary willpower to drive it through. It took 12 years, but we were a different country by the end of it. The unions were brought under the law, and the coal miners' strike was smashed. The nationalized industries were sold to private shareholders, every last one of them: steel, coal, electricity, gas, water, railways. The maximum tax rate was brought down to 40%. And people were given the chance to own shares and buy their own houses. The City of London was freed from the ancient restrictions, and it flourished as never before, not least as a magnet for American banks and financial institutions. It was an extraordinary agenda, and every bit of it had to be fought for. But Margaret Thatcher never lacked for courage and never put popularity ahead of doing what was right. She didn't want to be loved. She believed that if people saw results, they would vote for her, and they always did. You know, she never actually lost an election. She was only finally deposed, not by the country, but by a gutless majority of the Conservative Party in Parliament. There was another important factor, and that was the remarkable relationship between Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. They first met in the mid-70s, when both were out of office, and it was love at first sight. They discovered instantly that they believed in the same things: in private enterprise, in a small state which leaves the citizens the maximum space to run their own lives, in low tax, in strong defence, and in winning the Cold War, not just accepting that there would always be a Soviet Union as a threat. They wanted to win the Cold War. And together in office, they were unstoppable, and we all owe to them our victory in the Cold War and banishing the menace of communism, though I know you're in your immediate neighbourhood, there's still Cuba's museum-quality communism. Yet they were very different characters. President Reagan, sunny and upbeat, setting the general strategy, then leaving his cabinet to get on with it, a brilliant communicator of tough policies in a deceptively soft tones. Margaret Thatcher was the master of detail and every nuance of policy. You know, I sat in on every meeting they ever had together, and I confess I did occasionally see President Reagan's eyes stray to the clock on the wall, calculating just how many minutes it was to lunch and a martini, while Margaret Thatcher was explaining to him the more complex points of nuclear non-proliferation. But it was your and our great good fortune which brought them together at that juncture and enabled them to change the course of world history. There were, of course, some rather unusual features to working for a woman prime minister. She was never above exploiting her femininity, while having no truck, I have to say, with feminism. In all her years as prime minister, there was only ever one other woman in the cabinet, and she lasted exactly 6 months. I used to attend meetings, summits of all male presidents and prime ministers, and Margaret Thatcher, and all their all male advisers, with a spare pair of tights in my briefcase. And I used to pray the Secret Service would not insist on my opening my briefcase for inspection before meetings with President Reagan, in case they would wonder what on earth I was doing. No one could call her either a conventional diplomat. Apart from Americans, she didn't have much time for foreigners. She resented the European Union because she thought it dedicated to undermining national sovereignty of individual countries and parliaments. I think there are eternal lessons to draw from Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and their cooperation, and those are that clear principles are the best way of governing. Keep down taxes and spending. Keep your defences strong to make sure no enemy can threaten you. And above all, keep the United States and the United Kingdom close. Too many of those lessons are being lost just now. Now, that's a bridge for a quick word about Europe, because you must be wondering what the heck is going on as the European continent fails to solve its sovereign debt crisis and its financial problems, sinks back into recession, and puts at risk economic recovery in the US, the UK, and even more widely. Now, Europe's crisis did not have to be this bad. The euro currency zone is less indebted than the US is. Its public sector deficit is lower. It has the money it needs to support and recapitalize its banks and bail out its weaker member countries. The failure to resolve the crisis is a failure of policy and a failure of leadership. The core problem is the fundamental flaw in the euro, the European currency, which we in Britain stayed out of for good reasons. When the euro was set up, the member countries surrendered their national currencies and thus the ability to devalue, and they handed over control of their interest rates to a European central bank. But they kept the power to tax, to spend, and to borrow in their own hands. And just imagine for a moment if that were the case in the US, and Florida had an entirely different tax regime and spending policies from Texas. You couldn't run the dollar that way, and you can't run a single European currency that way, especially among economies at such very different levels of development as Greece and Germany. To have a true single currency, you would have to hand over tax-raising powers and every other aspect of managing the economy to a European finance minister with full powers. And that, frankly, is a step too far, even for the most fervent European enthusiasm. And it's that which really kept Britain out of the euro from the beginning. We would never leave decisions over taxes in the hands of anyone except our own parliament. That is the very foundation of democracy. Now, the result now is that the richer countries, and that really means Germany, are demanding huge cuts in spending and other austerity measures by the poorer countries as the price for providing them with help. And the risk is that if pushed too far to the wall, these poorer countries will just default on their debts and pull out of the single currency altogether. And that would lead, I have to say, to tremendous disruption in currency markets, as well as to social instability on a great scale in southern Europe. There is, I'm afraid, no real solution in sight yet, and it may get worse before it gets better. But it's in your interest, and it's in our interest in Britain, that a solution is found, because the collapse of the euro would frankly be a disaster. The way out is to strike a bargain whereby the indebted, poorer countries carry out sweeping structural reforms to their economies to make them more competitive, while the richer countries like Germany boost their domestic demand and thus give the poorer ones a chance to grow and trade their way out of trouble. That's going to be a very complex task, and I can't hold out hope that it's going to happen soon. And meanwhile, Europe is going to be in recession. Not a very severe one, but it's going to be in recession throughout the whole of this present year. Now, let me turn now, as Tom asked me to talk a bit about Asia, to which, as he said, I devote a lot of my time these days. He mentioned Jardine Matheson, the great Asian conglomerate. It's always been British run and led. It was founded in China in 1837, which makes it, by US standards, a pretty elderly company, but it is still very successful and very deeply embedded in the area. But you know, my own interest in Asia was piqued by two things. First was meeting China's formidable leader, Deng Xiaoping, with Margaret Thatcher in 1982 and 1984, when we were negotiating the future of Hong Kong. And among the many powerful leaders whom I met in my time, from President Reagan to Pope John Paul to Brezhnev to Gorbachev, Deng Xiaoping made the greatest impression of a man of immense power. He was tiny. His feet barely touched the ground when he sat in an armchair. He spoke Chinese with a very strong regional accent that needed two interpreters, one to get him out of Sichuan dialect into Chinese and the other from Chinese to English. But this man really, you could tell, was a man who ruled over 1.3 billion people, and he knew everything that needed to be known how to do it. No one could challenge him. But it was listening to him explaining in quite extraordinary details in 1982 his plans for China over the next 50 years, and his belief, even then, 30 years ago, that China would rise to become the world's largest economy. It seemed incredible at the time when you looked round at China with no street lighting, but barely no motor cars. But every year since has brought his vision closer to fulfillment, and he certainly convinced me that it was going to happen. Though I must say, for many years, I had difficulty convincing others of China's coming rise. The second reason was more complex. It did seem to me that with the end of the Cold War, we were moving into a new phase of history after 200 or 300 years of dominance by the European Atlantic area. The great ideological battles with communism and Nazism were largely behind us. Yes, there were still going to be problems with militant Islam and renegade states, but beneath the surface, something different was stirring, and that was the redistribution of economic weight and power in the world. And as the populous nations of Asia, first Japan, then Korea, Taiwan, Southeast Asia, then China, then India, as they grasped the power of the market and began to let it rip. So the world's economic center of gravity is moved decisively eastwards towards Asia. And it seemed to me, 20 years ago, that Asia was likely to be both the greatest challenge and the greatest opportunity which would face us. And that was particularly serious for us in Europe on two counts. First, Europe has moved away from the free market model far more than the US, even under the present president, affecting its competitiveness as it struggles with the cost of social safety and welfare states. And secondly, while the US faces both ways, across the Atlantic and across the Pacific, with the option of pivoting from one to the other, as it's starting to do, Europe does not have that option. To my mind, Europe risks being beached with its high-cost economic model. That means for us in Britain, we must lift our eyes above Europe and focus our efforts on Asia. And within Asia, it's China which is the real engine of economic development, both its own and that of the other Asian economies. Of course, China was very much in the news here last week with a visit to the US of China's almost certain next leader, Mr. Xi Jinping. I went to see him last November in Beijing, and you can't learn all that much from a single meeting. But I found him, first of all, very self-confident, secure in himself, which is unlike many recent Chinese leaders. Secondly, quite open. And thirdly, very attracted to many aspects of America. And I think he's going to be a plus in the relationship in the future. But even so, China is still a very different animal from other countries. It's, as Napoleon once said, an enigma wrapped in a mystery. One thing China is not these days, and let's be absolutely clear about this, China is not communist. Indeed, it's almost anything but. Ideology plays no real role in China at all. The Chinese Communist Party is actually just the Chinese ruling party. Nothing more, nothing less. It exists for one purpose, to stay in power. Nor is China like the old Soviet Union. People talk pretty freely in China. Any Beijing taxi driver will tell you the government's rubbish. And what really fires people up is material improvement. You've got 1.3 billion people who want to own an apartment. They want to own a car. They want to travel abroad. A growing Chinese middle class, which probably now numbers, by most definitions, 200 million people, not insignificant, is emerging. You know, China is now the world's biggest manufacturer of automobiles. It has more miles of freeway than the United States does. It has more miles of high-speed train track than any country in the world. And it's transforming itself in a way which took Europe several centuries, and even the United States a century or more. But it's doing it, it's transforming itself in a matter of decades. And the only way it can do that is by strong central control, by which all decisions are taken in accordance with a plan. So where a free market society is often chaotic, China is disciplined, and this gives it a huge advantage in dealing with others. It can target and acquire natural resources, oil, whatever it is, gold, copper, all around the world, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East. It can manipulate markets and currencies. It can nominate particular companies as national champions and direct where they invest. It is, frankly, a very formidable economic model, often called state capitalism, and one against which it's hard, though not impossible, to compete. I guess the question is, beneath the sky-high statistics, does China actually have feet of clay, which mean its drive for economic superpower status will eventually fall short? You can come up with quite a lot of reasons why that could be so. After all, Japan, which was once predicted to overtake the United States, just hit the buffers 20 years ago and has been largely stagnant since. Like Japan, China has an age structure problem looming. The one-child policy has meant that numbers now coming into the workforce to support an increasingly elderly population are declining. They've some way to go yet. China's costs are rising as people demand higher wages and it risks pricing itself out of the market to the benefit of countries like Vietnam and Bangladesh and Indonesia. China has the most ghastly environmental problems and an acute shortage of water. On the social front, the wealth gap is growing more rapidly than anywhere in the world. There are 117 acknowledged billionaires in China, which is more than any country in the world except the United States. Yet there are also more people living on $2 a day in China than in the whole of Africa south of the Sahara. The social safety net in terms of public health, education and pensions remains primitive. And wasteful overinvestment means that there's a lot of overcapacity emerging in sectors of China's economy. And above all, there's a very long way to go in terms of individual wealth. China may be the world's second largest economy in gross terms. It will probably become the world's largest economy within 5 to 7 years. But in wealth per head, it still ranks only number 94 in the world. Most important of all, the Chinese lack freedom, and that must one day become a constraint. You cannot have creative, inventive societies unless people have the freedom to decide for themselves and eventually choose their own government. And one day, the Chinese people will demand that. But for the moment, their priority is stability above all, while they improve their living standards and enjoy a better life. So an awful lot could go wrong with China, but I doubt in the end it will be the threat which it's sometimes assumed to be. You always have to remember that although Congress particularly tends to look at China as a threat, there are enormous benefits from China for American and European consumers of lower cost goods from China. It knocks an awful lot off the cost of living in this country. And China may be building up vast financial surpluses, but where does it invest them? It invests almost all of them in US treasuries, keeping down your interest rates and helping you to survive the recession. So my message is this, really. China and the US need to get on and avoid conflict if the 21st century world is to be better than the 20th century. The key is not to confront China, but to engage and entangle China in an ever-thickening web of obligations. No country in the world is more dependent than China on the global economy for its success, for raw materials, for markets, for productive investments, for its financial surpluses. China needs these to achieve growth. And for them, growth is the only foundation of political stability and the only source of legitimacy of the Communist Party's rule. And China, therefore, has a bigger interest in avoiding destabilizing conflicts than any other country. And perhaps one last major point. China's not a military threat. It really is not, despite some of the things you hear and read. China's never had territorial ambitions, and its military strength remains a fraction of that of the US. Although, quite sensibly, from its own point of view, it's investing in asymmetric technologies, like cyber warfare, rather than fleets of aircraft carriers or squadrons of F-35s. But China is a competitive challenge, and the ways to deal with that are twofold. First, coordinated pressure on China to enter agreements, to play the game by accepted rules, get them to recognize that only that way can they realize their own goals of stability and prosperity. We've succeeded in that in the past when we got China into the World Trade Organization, compelling them to open up their economy, reduce barriers, and override sectional interests. What we've done once, we can do again. The second answer is to make ourselves more competitive. That lies in our own hands, whether it's the US or Europe, and it's a very big task in both cases. I would say we've been going in the wrong direction in both our countries for quite some time because of political deadlock, excessive regulation, union power, and a host of other similar causes. You know, it's not rocket science to become more competitive, but it does require political courage, a massive adjustment of taxes and incentives, investment in education, removal of restrictive practices, and investment in technology. And my last word is this. I'm one of those who has deep and abiding belief in the ability of the American people to rise to challenges like this. Indeed, my whole life has been built on pro-Americanism, and it's always been vindicated in the past. I'm sure it will be this time too. But for goodness sake, get wise, break the political deadlocks, and elect people to govern you who see and understand the big picture like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher did. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Powell. We do have a
couple mementos for you to take with you as you return. Hopefully you have room and a little more of your luggage. First, a nice book about Naples, Florida, so you can remember your trip here.
Yes,
and then our close neighbor, Marco Island, so you can learn about Marco as well. And the third benefit we provide for you that I know you'll want to make use of, we have 370-some on the wait list to join, and if you would like to join the club, you immediately jump the wait list, and we look forward to seeing you for meetings.
I thought you would say I'd be the first member to join at the age of 140.
No. Well, you're going to jump the wait list, okay? Again, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Tom, go ahead.
Charles, if you do join, there's a modest fee that I charge for that service. All right, a lot of questions on China and the UK. I'm going to start with a student question. Do you think the one-child policy is beneficial, or in the future will it cause a problem in the work field?
It's a very good question. In one sense, no, I think the one-child policy is immoral. I don't think government should ever tell people how many children it can have. And it interferes with individual right and freedom of choice. And, of course, the way in which the policy is enforced is not just by deterring people by telling them, but by very, very widespread abortion. On the other hand, I would have to say, in all honesty, that in a country which already has a population as big as China, up against limited resources, limited space, and so on, unlimited population growth, as you see at the moment in India, which will quite soon overtake China in population, is not an easy thing to grapple with. Running a country of 1.3 billion is difficult. Running a country of 2 billion would be, I think, virtually impossible. It is going to cause problems in the work field, yes, because with fewer people now coming into the workforce, they won't be able to sustain the sort of pensions and benefits for the older generation as they retire. And it's sometimes said that China may be the first country to become old before it becomes rich. And that would really sum it up quite well. So the honest answer to what's a good question is I'm rather torn on what the right answer is. I can see it from both ways.
Why did China exercise its veto in favor of a non-UN intervention in Syria? And another one that's allied with that, why does China continue to support rogue countries, Iran, North Korea, risking a nuclear arms race?
Well, again, it's the answers are perhaps more complex than they seem. Why did China quite wrongly oppose any sort of UN resolution, Security Council resolution on Syria? For the Chinese, it goes back to their fears about their own country. They are very, very frightened that other countries will try to intervene in China and change their system. For them, it is an absolute principle that the United Nations should not interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. And they've stuck to that position for a pretty long time. But there have been exceptions. They, in the case of the first Gulf War, they abstained rather than vote against. And abstention is not exactly a heroic posture, but it does mean that intervention can happen and you don't block it. And they should have done that in this case. And I'm really not quite sure in my mind why they didn't do so. Remind me of the second part of the question was about Syria and...
Yes, Syria, North Korea,
Don't support... North Korea, you shouldn't really underestimate. I think behind the scenes, the Chinese are the only people who are in a position to play any sort of helpful role in North Korea. And they have once again managed to get North Korea and the United States together to talk. It is an absurd country, North Korea. It really is the hermit kingdom. Almost nobody goes there. The standard of living is appalling. One interesting fact I will tell you is that it's probably market sensitive, is that in Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, our biggest single customer for the most expensive cognac in the world was North Korea, and Kim Jong-il personally was the biggest consumer of it. So it does show you that equality was not a great feature of life in North Korea. But I think the Chinese are generally helpful in the sense they have no incentive in seeing a nuclear North Korea, because it will only encourage South Korea to get nuclear weapons too. They don't want instability on the Korean Peninsula. So slowly they're getting educated in these things and being brought round, but it's going to take a while yet.
I think you touched on it. Is it possible for China to become a U.S. partner for long-term peace?
I think it's possible, but it's going to be a very difficult road to get there. As I said, China has every incentive in a peaceful world. It is more dependent than any other country on the rest of the global economy. So conflicts are just not in its interest. On the other hand, it is extremely sensitive to outsider interference. It's particularly sensitive on the issue of sovereignty, sovereignty over Hong Kong, sovereignty over Taiwan. And that's a matter of history, because, of course, in the 19th century, the colonial powers, Britain, Germany, France, occupied parts of China, ruled them, and only returned them, in the case of Hong Kong, as recently as 1997. So that whole issue of sovereignty is very sensitive. It makes the Chinese very prickly, and they claim sovereignty over quite a bit of the South China Sea, where there may well be substantial oil reserves. So the US relationship with China is going to be very tricky. But for me, the most important thing is to avoid the sort of mentality which leads to another Cold War. The Cold War wasn't much fun, frankly. It wasn't fun for the US, which had to sustain the huge costs of it. It wasn't much fun for people in Europe who live within 3 or 4 minutes of nuclear annihilation from the Soviet Union. We don't want and we don't need that with China. So we must resist the temptation, which you sometimes get from the defense lobby, to talk up the China threat and say, oh, they're becoming a huge defense threat. Look, the Chinese have one second-hand Ukrainian aircraft carrier, which only put to sea after they'd had it for 8 years a few months ago. They are building up some increased air capacity, but basically they're focusing on things which won't cost them very much, which yet enable them to a degree to neutralize American assets, and cyber warfare is one, the ability to try to jam communications and military communications and so on. It's not enough to justify calls for the US budget, defense budget, to be hugely increased. I'm a bit alarmed by how much is being reduced at the moment, but I don't think there's a case in relation to China to see it increased.
This is about Israel and Iran. And the specific question is, should Israel bomb Iran's nuclear facilities with or without the U.S. help?
Not if it can possibly be avoided, but it may not be possible. There's a long history to this, and people sometimes forget it. Iran has aspired to be a nuclear power since the time of the Shah. He initiated, a great ally of the United States, I may say, he initiated the nuclear program then. And every government since, of whatever persuasion in Iran, has followed it and taken it a stage further. And you know, frankly, I believe that if ever we had a democratic revolution in Iran, I think a democratic government in Iran would also want to be a nuclear power. And the reason for that is quite simple. Iran regards itself as a great power in the region. On one side of it, it's got a military nuclear India. It's got Pakistan with nuclear weapons. To its west, it's got Israel with nuclear weapons. To its north, it's got Russia with nuclear weapons. Their belief is, why should we be the only one without that essential capability to preserve our security? And intellectually, at least, you can understand that. What you can't understand is if it goes with saying to Israel, we want to wipe you off the face of the map. And of course, that makes Israel extremely nervous. Now, does Israel have the capability to do a great deal about Iran's military nuclear program? It can't eliminate it. Let's face that. It could probably set it back. Even then, not, I fear, very much, a couple of years or so. The key parts of that program are being developed underground, where they're remote from anything Israel could do to attack it, and even the United States could do to attack it. Israel would have a very difficult military task. It would have to fly over hostile airspace to get to Iran. It would need to be able to refuel midair and so on. There's a lot of reasons to think that it would be very much the last gasp for Israel. There is a better way if we can do it, and that is getting these sanctions to work, to be really effective, so that Iran suffers so much pain from sanctions that they prefer to negotiate on stalling their nuclear program than really seeing their economy crumble and disintegrate. There are some very early, very tentative signs that they are prepared to re-engage in negotiation. It'll be long, it'll be painful, but if it can work, it's honestly a better solution for everyone. So it's well worth a try.
Here's an interesting subject, the Falklands. The Falklands War. Why? Don't need to get too personal here.
the why was very obvious. The Falklands, as everyone knows, are down there off the southern tip of Argentina. They are absolutely useless for Britain. We have no concrete interest in them whatsoever. There was a time in the 19th century when whaling ships used to put in there to load up on coal, but that went more than 100 years ago. But there is one issue with the Falklands, and that is its population, which is only about 2,000 people, are British, and every time there's a referendum asking them what they want, they say, we want to remain British. They don't say it by 60% or 70%, they say it by 100%. And in our society, you can't say to a country, we're terribly sorry, you may want to remain British, but we don't want you, so go away. So we have to defend our sovereignty over it. And when, in 1982, some Argentine generals, who were making a desperate mess of how they were running Argentina, needed a distraction, they decided they would be able to go and take the Falklands. They didn't think that Britain, at that stage of our history, would bother to send a task force 6,000 or 7,000 miles to recapture it. Well, they were wrong about Margaret Thatcher. Within 48 hours, she had assembled the task force, and it was sailing towards the Falklands, and the rest is history. It's a little alarming that now we're seeing a resurgence of rhetoric from Argentina about the Falklands. I personally don't think it's going to lead to anything very serious. After all, the only threat they can espy in the Falklands is the fact that Prince William is down there as an air sea rescue helicopter pilot. Then the threat to them is not really that serious. So I think this kerfuffle will probably go away. But that's the reason why we defend the Falklands, not because we want it or have any concrete interest in it, but in a democracy, you can't treat people in the way that others would like us to.
What is your view of the U.S. inability to address its own systemic financial issues? Are we in danger of becoming a European future, or having a European future?
Well, I profoundly hope not. And I'm always a bit cautious about telling Americans how they should better run their economy or their country. I think, actually, at the end of the day, you did rather a good job of getting out of the very steep recession and following the sort of collapse of the system. And you did a better job of it than we're doing at the moment in mainland Europe. And I do say mainland Europe, not because I'm sort of anti-European in a broad sense, but simply Britain is not part of the Eurozone, is not part of these measures trying to revive continental mainland Europe. But we're going our own way, as so often in the past. I think the political deadlock is a really major issue, and it does you huge damage. I mean, there are solutions which could be adopted, but they can only be adopted by reaching a consensus between the executive arm and the legislative arm. In the past, you've managed to do that. It was done in President Clinton's time with a largely Republican, indeed exclusively Republican, Congress. It could be done again. I doubt it's going to be done in an election year. All that said, I'm actually quite encouraged by some of the signs in the US economy at the moment that this will be a better year. And I think there will be growth this year. And I've seen estimates from reputable economists who are talking perhaps of 3% growth this year, which would, by historical standards, not be a steep recovery, but nonetheless would be a useful and valuable one. And provided the Chinese can keep their economy fairly stable as a great sort of force on the world economy, and the rest of the Middle East and Latin America, and even Africa. People always overlook Africa. Africa is actually, at the moment, one of the fastest-growing parts of the world. Provided they all keep steady, I think this could be quite a good year for the U.S., and Europe will be the real back marker.
If you think back to the first Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the second Bush, and now President Obama, how would you describe the relationships that the United States has with UK, reflective of the previous presidents, and now we're facing President Obama?
Well, as you know, we like to talk of the special relationship with the US. It's actually a fairly recent invention. After all, you have to remember that in the 19th century, we burned down the White House. And really, the special relationship dates from the Second World War. And it was basically a military and an intelligence relationship to begin with because of the war. But it flourished after that. But it's never been exactly even. It's never been a steady state. Various presidents have set it back a bit. Various prime ministers have set it back a bit. Harold Wilson in Britain, the socialist, wouldn't support the United States in Vietnam. The relationship plummeted a bit then. President Carter was not particularly enthusiastic about the special relationship, to say the least. President Reagan was, and really brought it up to new heights, but that depended in good part on the personal relationship between him and Margaret Thatcher and their very similar beliefs and views and ideologies. George Bush carried that on, really. Bill Clinton, I think, started being a bit anti-British, not least because the British Conservative Party had very unwisely been helping his opponents in the presidential election. But it came round. George Bush Jr., of course, developed a very close link with Tony Blair over the Iraq War, and it was certainly a unique relationship at that time. It was closer than the US with any other country. I would have to say that at the moment, I think it is of a rather different quality for many different reasons. One is that, as far as I can establish, President Obama has no background with Britain or with Europe. He never visited it before he became president. He has no cultural or family links with the area. Basically, he looks the other way. He looks towards Asia for understandable reasons. And therefore, you can't really talk about the relationship as being of the same quality as it has been in the past. Does that mean I think it will never recover to its previous quality? No. I think under a different president, and depending who it is, it could well resume its rather special status. You'll find our Prime Minister, David Cameron, is coming here in March, I think, on a big visit. There'll be a lot of trumpeting of the special relationship then, but I'm afraid that just using the words doesn't always convey the substance, and I'm afraid the substance at the moment is not quite what it was.
Britain for many years has allowed foreign immigration to a point where it is now a problem. How do you see do you first of all agree that this is a problem? And second, how do you see a solution to this issue?
Immigration everywhere is a political problem because it causes disequilibrium in society. People of a different race or culture suddenly arrive and start to fill particular cities, particular districts of cities, school systems and so on. It causes problems. People are envious if they're given priority in housing. They're unhappy if the school system is set back a bit because of the need to teach people in the lower school classes English even before they can start on the curriculum. So it's always a problem. It's particular in our case. There are two factors to it. One is a lot of our immigration is from the Commonwealth. And, of course, originally the Commonwealth people, India, all these countries, the 52 countries of the Commonwealth, were entitled to full British citizenship. And so that had to be eroded over the years. We could never have coped with the volume of immigration from India and Pakistan had we led all the right just to come to Britain and become instantly British. So we've had to put increasing numbers of restrictions. The other is that under European law in the European Union, there's complete freedom of movement between European countries and freedom of being able to work. So we have no legal basis. We can exclude anyone from the 27 countries of the European Union, and they can't exclude anyone from Britain, of course. Actually, we don't have, in practice, a very serious problem. We have had in the past. We've had race riots in the 60s, particularly with our Caribbean population, most of whom came after the Second World War from the Caribbean islands, from lack of work in the sugar plantations, the banana plantations. And more recently, our biggest problem, frankly, has been with the Pakistani population, because as Muslims, they lead a different form of life. The women are kept at home in a veil still. They mostly don't learn English. And they tend to concentrate in a few areas of the country where there are a very large proportion of the population. And, of course, that is made worse by the fact that there are Islamic extremists amongst the Islamic population. And it's quite difficult for our version of the FBI and the CIA to keep track of them. In the past, our security services have always looked for Soviet spies or Irish terrorists, and now suddenly they're looking for Islamic terrorists in small Midlands towns amongst a Pakistani population speaking Urdu, which very few of our policemen speak. So it's there is a problem there, but it's not too serious a problem. It's magnified by politics. It's always a temptation for politicians to play the immigration card. In some areas, we actually need more immigration of talented and skilled people. I think the same is true in the United States.
This is a very serious and critical question. In the United States, we play a sport called soccer. I believe you refer to it as football in your country. Are you giving any chance to the Americans to beat the Brits at the World Cup soccer tournament?
Well, you know, we're playing so badly at the moment that the same might be true. But at least when we play our national sport, we don't have to put on a suit of armor anymore.
Thank you very much. Nice one.
Thank you.